This session is part of the presentation of the scientific committee presentations that center around energy, but not wholly around energy, as the presentation yesterday and the presentation on Monday suggest. But today I want to discuss the issue of energy as a religious issue. And let me summarize where I've been. I'm sure this isn't where we've been, but we begin with a notion of creation, that the world was created in order to be used and enjoyed, to use Augustine's phrases. That the world was created means that the world has a meaning, that there was some intent for the world and for our use and enjoyment of the world. That it's God's intention that we use and enjoy the world in accordance with his intention. So I say that to know Christ is to know the created order. It's to live in accordance with the created order, and that order is Christ. That is the Word, through which and in which the world was created. It's in the Trinitarian conception, it's to live in accordance with the second person. So to know and to live in accordance with Christ is to live in accordance with his created intention for the world. Now what we have covered in the last few sessions, I'll try to summarize in a few propositions. First, that fossil fuels exist in very finite quantities. Simply finite quantities. And second, that fossil fuels pollute. So the conclusion that I reach, and I think many of us have reached, is that we should use fossil fuels carefully and prayerfully, both with regard to their finite nature and with regard to their polluting effects. What I call careful use or a caring use. And this involves a whole notion of stewardship in the use of fossil fuels, both because we're using them up and because of their polluting effects. The second thing we discussed was the substitution of nuclear fission energy for fossil fuel energy. And I think we could conclude, I conclude, and of course always is my interpretation, that in using the nuclear fission processes, we face the same finite limitation with regard to the amounts of uranium that are present in the world. And I think that we have the same problem in using uranium, particularly in the fission process, and in the light water, heavy water reactors, which use up the uranium. We have a little different problem in the breeder reactor. But we have a problem in terms of just using it up, and it won't be available for anybody. Then we had a debate about pollution. I think the problems of using nuclear fuel are controversial. And I don't think there's general agreement. Some of us would think that the dangers of pollution from the wastes, particularly from the wastes of nuclear fission, are larger than others would think. And some of us think that the problems with the misuse of the fuel, particularly if plutonium is floating about the world in large amounts, some of us think that the dangers are greater than others, and therefore some are much more ambiguous than others about the use of the fission process at all. I don't know what we conclude about the breeder. Certainly, if we continue to use nuclear fission in the light water and heavy water reactors, and those that use up the fuel is over against breeding the fuel, we have more of a problem in terms of our caring for the future. So there's a problem of stewardship in the careful use or the caring use, both with regard to using up and with regard to pollution. Then we talked a little, but not too much, about the alternatives. We really haven't dealt much with fusion, nuclear fusion. Solar seems to be quite a ways down the peak. Geothermal is a kind of question mark. Thermal gradients, using the differences in temperature in large bodies of water. Bioconversion, use of organic waste. I guess there's no question about the use of organic waste. The question in using organic waste is whether we pump them back onto the land and use them as fertilizer, or whether we burn them up. And again, it's a question of caring use of resources we have. Now, what I want to go on to talk about, I think that's a kind of overall view of some of the topics that lead us into the question of what I call energy wants versus energy needs, or energy habits versus energy needs. Let me put the question the way it appears to me at first blush, by suggesting what happens if we use oil the way we are using oil. And this is only kind of to get us thinking. As we use 6 billion barrels plus oil a year for 200 million people, if you say that that's the way oil should be used, then you're going to use 120 billion barrels of oil for 4 billion people, or 4,000 million, for 480 billion barrels of oil for 16,000 or 16 billion people. So you're using 400 billion barrels a year. Now, the highest possible estimate, a realistic estimate, I think, is about 3,000 billion barrels of oil. So you're using 400 billion, 480 per year, and a realistic estimate for the world, I think, is 3,000 billion. My figure, and I've looked at all kinds of estimates, is 3,000 to 12,000 billion, you know, in terms of the limits. So that you don't have many years of oil if other people develop the use of oil that we have. I think it raises a question. And the same problem would be involved with non-renewable metals. Now, my question arises around trying to universalize our way of life. And I conclude that there's no way to hold up our way of using oil as something that's open to human beings generally. And that raises a question about a way of life that's only open to a small part of the world. If you're really thinking about God's intention for humanity generally, so at least it raises a question about our present sources of energy and the possibilities for the future. And you may say what it does is to push us towards some other sources of energy, since you can't universalize the use of oil. And I don't think you could universalize the use of coal either. I figured out that at our present use of coal, I mean at the present use of energy, if we were using only coal for energy for 16 billion people, we would have 5 years of coal in the world. That is, if everybody was using coal in as much quantity as you would have to use coal to produce the amount of energy that we're using per capita. So that certainly the coal isn't the alternative. But of course, in the near future, with the exception of the problems of pollution, which generally I think can be met, you've got some problems of lung disease and other problems and reclamation problems, you could use coal for an intermediate substitute. The other question is about a way of life and what God's intention is for our being human. What does it mean to be in the image of God? What does it mean to be faithful? And that's what I want to ask about today. And these are very preliminary kinds of probings that I present. It seems to me that we have to begin to think about what's involved in our way of being. and ask why we are like we are, what I call the religious approach or the religious issue. And I do that by just beginning to ask the question, why we use so much energy? Why do we use so much energy? And I have a number of observations and probings. And I think that we use so much energy because we have been conditioned to live with what I call artificial necessity. The realm of necessity is the realm of the goods and services needed in order to sustain life. I think this is kind of what we generally think of. When you think of necessity, it's what is necessary to sustain life. And I don't know whether I want to believe this or not, or whether it's actually a fact, but I think we live in a world in which the realm of necessity has been expanded until it's all out of proportion to our needs. That is, to our needs for survival. Now, there are other kinds of needs. There are needs for meaning and for creativity and other things. But the things and services that we think we need have become so much a part of us that they function almost like biological needs. And here I follow Herbert Marcuse's analysis in Eros and Civilization, where I first ran into this notion that these needs are very, I mean, they become so much a part of us because of our socialization process that we think we need everything. Evelyn Strang was talking about being in Brazil and being in some of the older hotels where they didn't have air conditioning and they had shutters. They had ways of letting the wind in and keeping the sun out, and she said it wasn't too bad. And then she also talked about the fact that air conditioning has brought about the elimination of the siesta in the warmer climates, and that there's a whole way of life that was related to the heat of the day. And it's permitted the so-called lethargic southerners to become energetic, go all the time northerners. And I'm just trying to, just a conversation with Evelyn I had this morning at the breakfast. She couldn't be here and she wanted to be here, and we were talking about some of the things that were involved. So that it seems to me that the multiplication of things and of services creates expectations that drive us in all that we do. And we live under this domination of artificial necessity. And this domination, I think, is our chief problem or the chief question about our existence. So the first way to deal with the energy crisis, and I think with most of our problems, is to become free from the domination of artificial necessity. There seems to be no limit to the possessions and services we seem to seek in order to be human. And I know, since I began to think this way, it just bothers me to see all the old suits I've got hanging around. Most people throw them out, I guess. I never throw anything out. Because style changes, the lapels change, you know. And Sarah wanted me to get, and I fell in with the, you know, getting something a little more modern and not looking so much like an old timer and all this stuff. And there are reasons, of course, why I'm more sensitive about that than some other people, given my married situation. I just have to face these kinds of things that are real. We use so much energy because we have allowed or been enticed into allowing the realm of necessity to be expanded. What we think we need in order simply kind of to be. That's one thing that I notice or that I attend to or that I've been led to attend to in explaining why we use so much energy. And while clothes, for example, are not high on the energy intensive list compared with many other things. They are energy intensive. They just use energy in order to make them. The second reason we use so much energy can be found in our preference for the new. We think that the new is better than the old. And I think we live under the domination of the new. This is just part of our old cultural, what some of the sociologists call our ethos. The new is not something we choose. That is, we don't deliberately sit down and say, well, I need something new. But down underneath, we are conditioned to think that the new is better than the old. Our universities, for example, emphasize new knowledge. My favorite illustration is the search for a new topic for a thesis that somebody dealt with, the canning of spinach. And I always say, for a person who's writing a thesis, write something that has some meaning for you. And I don't care whether it's new or not. But the university wouldn't like that. I mean, I am not in favor with the faculty generally for this. And I'm sure that some of the theses I've sponsored, you could find somebody else somewhere around the world who'd done the same thing. But it must be new. It's the same with regard to clothes and cars. And the only people I found who have the strength to choose old clothes or cars and to keep them for a long time, of course they can afford to buy good ones so they last forever, are the old line aristocratic families. And they have enough status somehow so they can wear things that aren't in fashion. They're quality things. My mother always taught me, and she was not an aristocrat, she was a social climber, that you ought to get good things, take care of them, and wear them forever. And it's, you know, my mother is so deep in me sometimes I think I'll never escape her. My father I can't quite locate, but I can locate my mother every single minute of my existence. Boy. At any rate, everyone seeks the new in order to achieve the status he or she wishes to have. And I think that's very important for us, that the use value of the new is much less important than the status value of the new. The use value of the new is much less than the status value of the new. And this is very ambiguous, because I think sometimes when life is dragging, we go buy something. We just go buy something, and there's a lift to just buying something new. You probably all experienced this. And I must admit, when I go downtown for some reason, and see all the stuff in the stores, I really have temptations to just buy stuff. When I was a senior in college, I represented a men's furnishing store downtown, a little store, and sold clothes. Well, I didn't make any money because I bought clothes. And when we were going to school, I wore a stiff collar and a suit every day my junior and senior year of college. You know, we were dressed to the hilt, and I was the worst of all. And I had to have full dress and a top hat and Chesterfield coat and white gloves and all this kind of stuff, you know.
Where was this?
This was the University of Chicago. And I still have the top hat. It's kind of a symbol. I sent the Chesterfield to Europe during the war, you know, with the problems of Reconstruction and so forth. I got rid of it, but I couldn't get rid of that other symbol. Every once in a while I get it out. I still have those tails hanging around that I never wear. Once I wanted to have a young people's program in our church, and I called it Man or Mannequin. I dressed up in all this stuff. And boy, I really was a mannequin when I was a senior in college. I bought into that thing completely. And partly it was that I didn't have enough status in my being to resist the temptation to get that status by my front, by my appearance. I wasn't confident enough in my own being, and I know that. So I put on a great front. Now, the issue is not simply that the new is destructive and the old constructive. The issue, I think, lies in the role the new plays, because it is new, regardless of whether or not it really is useful. And I think the question here is just like in the realm of necessity. That is, there are necessary things, and it's the question of the overdoing it, of the emphasis. What is the role of the new or of the necessary? And what is the meaning attached to what we see? What's it doing for us? What purpose does it serve? What kind of hidden motives are attached to and sometimes not so hidden, to what we are doing? What meaning, in other words, do we derive from having and going and doing? Very basic question, of course, and I think I'll get to it later in terms of whether we're justified, you know, by God's act, or whether we're justified by what we have in terms of the new and in terms of what we do. The third reason we use so much energy, I think, involves the notion of self-creation. We must be the creators. Now, sometimes we dress this up and call ourselves co-creators. As over against using organic materials, for example, that participate in a natural cycle, in a natural rhythm, we create synthetic materials which cannot be absorbed back into nature. I'm not sure that's because we want to create something new. There are certain advantages in to having these synthetic fibers, because I always like a crease in my pants. And it's certainly a lot easier when you have these synthetic fibers. Crease isn't exactly like I like to have it in terms of my former way of life. You know, it's not as precise as I'd like to have it, but nevertheless, I don't have to press it and get out that ironing board. And since I, you know, press all my old clothes, and I don't have a slave in the way of a female around that does all these things for me. There seems to be an over-evaluation of our capacity to create an approach to life in which we are in control. And nature seems to be saying no to some of our self-creation. It seems to be saying no to the synthetics. If synthetics can't be absorbed back into nature, there's a real question, I think. I mean, they're just around to litter. The environment cannot absorb the results of our creation. Can't absorb the polluting effects. And what is involved in this situation, I think, is the question of boundaries or limits. That is, nature, it's almost as if nature, in a way, in pollution particularly, is saying, well, you've gone beyond the limits of my creation. I mean, there is an order of creation. There's an order which sustains human life. And you are not free to create what you want. I think it's more involved than simply nature saying this, because our cities are uninhabitable, really, for the most part now, for anybody. At least Chicago is. You don't want to walk around at night, and you're always wondering about what's going to happen. We've created a way of life that's created social disorder, too. So it isn't just nature that's somehow saying no. It's much more involved, I think. So when we use the term co-creation, if we really take it seriously, it means we're creating within the limits of a creator, or of a given, of some boundaries, of some parameters, all these fancy words that people use, within which one has to function. Now, I think these three aspects of our life, the domination of artificial necessity, of the new, and of self-creation, are in part responsible for our large consumption of energy. And they involve broad aspects of the meaning structure of our lives. But there are a number of supporting factors. One of these is the notion of freedom as self-initiation. And I don't need to say much about that because Leo really opened it up last night. That is, freedom as self-initiation emphasized the fact that we're the initiators. And the whole history of thought has set that over against the notion of freedom in which the issue is more what is initiated, much more what is initiated than being one of whether or not the self or another person initiates. In the second view of freedom, it's important to initiate in relation to what? In relation to the givens, in relation to the will of God. In, as Luther said, I'm free from all, from everything, from every man, and I'm a slave. I'm a slave of Christ. I am free in relationship to a demanded, to an order of existence. And my real freedom, and when you use the second notion, you always hear this word real, authentic freedom, is in doing the good or in being in accordance with God's will for my being. This comes out, of course, in relation to the issue of whether or not we are going to accept the government's regulation of the amount of the number of miles it will get on a gallon of gasoline for a car. And over again you hear, well, I want to be able to buy a gas guzzler if I want to. And you get a real question about whether that freedom to use up the resources of the world without regard to the future people or to the polluting effects is a good kind of freedom. And personally, I think these two things have to be balanced. As you'll see in all of these cases, I don't think it's quite a question of either or, but it's a question of some balancing. And the principle of equality functions in somewhat the same way. We use the notion of equality to justify producing more and more and using more energy. In other words, we think everybody ought to be equal, and the argument is frequently used. Well, we can't say to the rest of the world that they ought to use, that everybody ought to use much less energy, because they ought to be free to use as much energy as we do. I don't think we really want to subject ourselves to the principle of equality if 800 million Chinese and 600 million Indians have to be taken into account. I really don't think we believe in that kind of equality, because as you can see, when I began to talk about equality and the use of oil, it'd just be gone. It'd go poof. Or poof, poof, poof. But the principle of equality functions within our own social system in such a way that we advocate equality regarding whatever there is to be had. And the way we've solved our social problems, I think, in the past, is to increase everything, and then the people at the bottom get some. I mean, we get, the people at the top get a lot more, and the people at the bottom get a little, and everybody, and the people in the middle get some more, and everybody feels better because everybody is getting a little more. And so economic growth, increase in the GMP, and everybody gets a little bit more than he or she had, and we solve the problem that way. In other words, we push toward a kind of equality, but we don't ask about the content very much. And we think we're being moral if we advocate other people having as much as we have. We think we're being moral. And I think that's a way to avoid the question of the content of our lives or the substance of our culture. I just see equality as a formal principle which is useful, helpful. God knows I've spent enough of my energy trying to get equality for black people. But every time I did, I create a couple of black millionaires. Every time I did, I thought to myself, you know, what am I doing? I am helping them get into the white middle-class rat race. And there's some values again. I don't want to be mistaken, but I'm just kind of probing and asking questions. Another aspect of our lives that results in high energy demand is a focus on the individual. It's related to the notion of freedom and self-initiation. The emphasis is upon the individual. This results in the atomization of life. Even the nuclear family is not the most significant unit. The most significant unit for us is the individual, who moves in and out of relations almost at will. That's not completely true, but it certainly is true, truer. And there's some values in that. But the family illustrates the movement in the direction of individualization. Every family has all its own gadgets. In our church, we have 8 people who are living in one great big mansion. They bought for $39,000, and none of them could afford it alone. And they have all kinds of things, but they only have one of everything they need. And instead of having 2 people owning that home or 4 people owning that home, they have 8 people using all the gadgets. And this could be, I think of the kibbutz in Israel, where kind of symbolically, they have 700 people and 4 lawnmowers. And this is Paul Haynes' kind of symbolic statement of the issue, that everybody on his block in Dallas had a lawnmower which was used an hour a week, and he didn't. But of course you got problems if you start borrowing, and you got all kinds of problems, and he admits that. And part of the reason he's going to Seattle and begin to form a community which tries to relate people to each other in the use of things is to cut down on the need to have all, for everybody to have all these things. And as he says, the quest of living together is difficult because we have prided ourselves on living separately and on having everything of our own. And there are certain advantages. And there are disadvantages. I mean, if you take China, for example, they have found a way of dealing with all kinds of issues at the level of necessity for 800 million people, and at some cost, of course, to the individual, because the community is central. And you read some of their literature, and they just talk about the community as the focus. And seems to me that the whole issue of self-constituting yourself is over against being constituted by the community is part of the problem, because I believe that self-constitution is part of being human. The other part, of course, is what you constitute yourself for, and that to me is equally important. But if you take the Pauline image of the body, which is over and over again in the Pauline corpus, you've got an organic metaphor for being. You don't have an individualistic, atomistic metaphor for what being is. The church is the body of Christ. It's a body with arms and legs and hands and eyes, and they're all part of it, and you can't live without any of the parts. But it's an organic metaphor as over against a mechanical metaphor in terms of which you relate externally parts. I've done a little painting, and I didn't bring them up, put these different understandings of being graphically. We use so much energy in part because we hold in principle that the notion that the social, the economic realm is independent. And I don't know really what to do with this. Paul Hayne and I go round and round because he believes in the market more than I do, and I believe in it enough to really listen very carefully to what he's saying. But the notion somehow that you can seek your own self-interest, or the corporations can seek their own self-interest, and the interaction of those self-interests will lead to the good, I think creates a real problem. It creates a problem just spiritually for me to seek your own self-interest. But I'm enough of a pessimist about human nature to know that you could use that as a regulative principle. But to use it as a constitutive principle for the good really bugs me, and I just have to admit it. And yet that is the fundamental image, fundamental social policy with which we operate. We abrogate it in all kinds of ways, but it still is the dominant image. And so it allows all kinds of self-interest and interest in profit to dominate. And I don't know whether it's good or bad. If you take the bottle bill, for example, it's clear that the corporations that produce cans lose money in the beginning, and maybe in the long run, it's a headache to the beer companies and the soft drink companies, and the wage earners who are in the skilled trades in aluminum and steel in the manufacture of cans suffer, and you have lower paying job substitutes. So the unions fight it because they'll lose members, the unions who have the skilled workers who are producing the cans. Somebody's got to produce the bottles, of course, but the job increase, there's actually increase in jobs, but it comes in low-paying jobs in collecting the bottles and returning the bottles and storing the bottles and washing the bottles and that kind of thing in terms of the returnable bottles. But the companies that are going to lose money, spend millions of dollars, said $20 million a year fighting bottle bills. And they do it in the name of people ought to have a choice. And it's not a completely clear thing, although I found almost no argument against the bottle bill. But in other words, companies following their self-interest have the resources to fight against with public relations, you know, specialists fight against. And how you get the truth and how you get a public decision that's wise out of that is a difficult thing for me. Well, I can go on for a long time about some of these. I think we also live under the tyranny of technology. We do what we can do, almost without exception. There have been a few exceptions, an airplane or something we didn't develop that we could have. What was that airplane that we finally decided not to develop? We go to the moon if we can go to the moon. And for some things that are good, and I don't know what to do with technology. There's a great argument as to whether technology is kind of neutral, you can use it either way you want, or whether it really involves a way of being. And Heidegger claims it involves a way of being. It involves a way of being in which the controlling, that is, things are at our disposal, and one can order and control and shape. And he claims it's not neutral. And I'm inclined to agree, but I think my arguments are largely emotional, and that if I had to defend it intellectually, I'd come down on the side that it's neutral, and it can be used one way or another. But it seems to me that we tend to do what we can do, and we invoke technological advance, so to speak, and use it almost regardless of the meaning of it in terms of the human. Now, there have been some steps back in industry where some industries have decided that simply because we have the technology, put things on a line, and they have everybody doing a little bit of it, that's destructive. And actually, they can get more production if they break it down into larger units and don't do what they could do technologically. That is, they begin to think of the human element and the meaning element in terms of people participating in these things. It's only a step, it seems to me, from controlling things in order to use them to a way of thinking and acting in which everything is considered instrumentally. And I couldn't but feel last night, in part, that we were thinking about how you win an election. that the analysis was in terms of why people are responding. And it's a way of dealing with an issue is to ask how you can get response. So human relations becomes a matter of calculation and manipulation as over against a matter of somehow truth and meaning and values. Present is always viewed as a kind of step toward the future. I think we all get involved in this as an instrument which serves a goal that can only be realized in the future. So it seems to me that this way of looking at things leads to a tyranny of the future. We are unable to be present for anyone because we are always standing there with one eye toward the future. I think of the preacher shaking hands with you in the morning, and he's got his eye on the next person before you get by, in the sense in which he has to. And I find myself up here sometimes just kind of relating instrumentally to people. I think I ought to know their names and so forth, but I can't attend to them because I got my eye on all kinds of other things. And instead of somehow finding in that very situation, that presence, the present, a meaning which has little to do with the past or the future. It is there. Mm-hmm. It's just there. I think probably I ought to stop. I find I've got a few more things to say, but maybe it's time for some discussion. We do have another hour tomorrow to do something in. I've got science and the technocrats, and I have the difference between achievement and ascription, and get into the notion of grace there, as where one's status is not by achievement, but it's an ascribed status that's given by as a gift. And that really takes us into justification by grace, the notion of grace. Life is given, grace is over against demand, task. And I just want to conclude then by saying that for the most part, my thinking is dialectical. It's a kind of both and. And one looks at where one is and sees a focus, and I see the focus way over in one side of a dialectic day, and I guess for that reason or other I come off as being almost absolute in terms of a denial of technology and a denial of the new and a denial of things, because you have to speak fairly strongly in order to make a point. General thesis being that if we're going to deal with energy carefully, we will deal with the meaning of our being, and we can't do it institutionally or legally or manipulatingly, or we've got to do some things there, but fundamentally it drives us to ask a question about the meaning of our being. I am. I just finished lecturing.
Well, I suppose the reason people arrive at certain conclusions about why things happen depends a little bit on the discipline they come out of. But certainly one reason why we use the energy we do is an economic one, that it is cheap. It has been historically, and it's readily available. Now, when those things change, we certainly will not consume it in the way we have in recent years. Buffalo would be a pretty good example.
Yeah, it's just, if it gets very expensive, we'll substitute human labor for energy.
Dave, you know, in both cases, you're under bondage. Mm-hmm. You're under bondage because you do what's there, and it's available without considering anything else except that it's available. That's bondage. Then you're under bondage that if you can't have it and you want it, then you're in bondage because you can't just flow with that it isn't there. So in both cases, you're still not down to being, just being and knowing where you are.
You have almost across the board use of energy by the people in this country. I don't think they're all philosophers. I think that it's almost in the category of breathing the air. It's there and it's cheap and we do it without thinking about it.
That's the problem though. They're just doing it. They're not thinking. Yeah, okay.
I'm directing my comment only to the reasons why we're consuming in the quantity we are.
Oh, yeah.
And well, I think that's going to change. As Al said, with a finite quantity available, we can be forced to make some.
I guess you still didn't get my point, because I'm saying, well, I think what Al is saying is we need to re-examine why we exist or what we're existing for. And and the reasons why we do things doesn't have anything. Let's see.
Okay, that's an ongoing the question that the mankind should have before them. I don't think the fact that we have a lot of cheap energy available or do not have it readily available answers the question of man's meaning for existence.
It's easier to exist with energy than without. It makes life easier. It also makes things, makes us more powerful. We can do more. We can accomplish more with energy than without it. If it is in our grasp, it is something we can afford, then isn't it natural? If we use it until there is some crisis that prevents us.
Yes, certainly it makes things physically easier.
That's a very individualistic viewpoint, which of course the Chinese have had to abandon immediately in terms of their community group. If I can afford to do things, then that makes it right for me. That's a sort of a platform to operate on that leaves out a lot of other reasons why I can afford it. How do I decide that I can afford it? Because I have the money in the bank, or because I don't have to pay attention to what my brother needs? See, all the criteria for deciding whether I'd afford it or not are tied up in this thing you're talking about here, and that you're talking about, I think. But having the money to pay for something and the desire to use it may not be the only two criteria upon which we have a right as human beings, much less as Christians, to decide whether we can afford it. I think that's where the torture comes personally in terms of how to decide whether I have the right to use it.
For me, in the same, the foundation of what is truth or what is meaning and being, and the words you're using, there is the freedom to use what we have and to develop. I think that's part of the freedom. I mean, it isn't that we keep our standards low and we become the monastic thing of self-denial. I don't think that's a Christian thing either. Just stomp down on the body and yet our desires are not always. There are several considerations. So, it's kind of two strands in our own thought. And what determines that? What determines which one you should listen to? Of our own, at least from my own, basis of what is true.
This is our discussion. You ought to look at me. We ought to be looking at each other. I just.
And again, an awfully good point the other night, I think, that when you consider reducing your own consumption, what do you do with the reduction? And I think this is one of the things that Paul King is going to have to answer in his community. Depending on then how you allocate your resources, it may not be wise stewardship with the savings, quote unquote. Like you made the example of leaving money in the bank, well, what do the banks do with it?
The thing is not to earn so much money. And, I think a whole way of life is involved, and my thesis is that we ought to work less to earn money and be freer to do other things, or we ought to spend our money on things that are very low in energy, but not simply because they're low in energy, only because I think there's some correlation between things that are low in energy and being human. I think there's some correlation there. Now, I think Rudy's raised questions as to how much correlation there is, because there is also a correlation between having energy to use and being human. Because if you work 18 hours a day at physical labor, you're not good for anything else, as you know, in terms of feeling or being present or taking care of the kids. Taking care of kids, in my experience, is largely, it's partly a matter of attitude, but partly it's just a matter of the physical energy you got to keep up with those kids, man. I never could do it, and by I couldn't even have the energy to read to them at night sometimes, because reading to them, I was just dead, physically.
Some aspects of energy use, I think, are also tied to the pressures of urbanization. For example, I don't have a clothes dryer, because I still have a single family house with a little backyard, and I'm on principle and not called a clothes dryer, and I can hang my clothes on the line. I love it. But obviously, you can't do that in the city of Clinton. I don't have a garbage disposal. I bury my organic garbage in the backyard from my little garden. Now, what do you do in city apartments, you see, and especially in places where it's very hard to get rid of garbage?
Roof gardens, there are all kinds of possibilities.
Possibilities, but you know, there's a limited space.
I know.
Yeah, but I mean, urbanization patterns, I think.
I agree. I agree.
Energy consumers.
Urban patterns. My feeling or observation or assessment are based upon high energy use. I mean, the suburbs, the travel distance.
The whole thing.
Sarah drives 40 miles a day to work in our great big gas guzzling car.
And sometimes economics plays a part in what you were saying with the garbage disposal and things, but in our neighborhood, the garbage rates have gone up so fantastically that people who have never thought of putting garbage disposal in said, okay, that's it, I'm going to go out and put a garbage disposal in, I'm not going to pay those kind of prices. Mm-hmm. So now they're paying the energy price, which is worse.
Conserved electricity, and then the electrical companies had to raise their rates because decreased.
More now.
Yeah, we had to pay more for using less energy.
We're doing that with gas energy.
And of course, that may not be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on what you need the money for, the extra money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think this is all associated with ways of life which we develop, which get rid of the notion you got to send your kids to a private college and all that kind of stuff. I think a great deal is involved in rethinking how we're going to be.
I react real positively to that, and I'm associated in the last few years with a lot of young adults who have done some pretty good pioneering in some lifestyle, and older adults, some of us have tried to follow a few of those patterns. And in this context of the religious values and understandings, how is it, could you maybe comment on this, how do we develop not an 18-hour day, but a 30-hour week, so that we can do some of these other fine points of living without denying our sense of stewardship? You have special gifts. Maybe a technological person has special gifts, that we don't just lie around in the sun all the time. We should some of the time. Do we have that problem in this whole readjustment to the quality of life?
I don't know. I just don't want to comment all the time.
Yeah, you really do. You look at the hunger of the world, you can't just drop out yourself. You've got a responsibility to your fellow man.
And how much?
Right.
So you mean you should drive, or more than we're doing, to make that responsibility, or is it possible to have that responsibility exercised in a different way?
Well, I would think in the first place, I think it's a community decision. And I don't know where the church is that's going to help us make these decisions. We need to make them together. And some people might work 12 or 12 hours a day and earn a lot of money, and they might have the gifts and they might have a situation that was required for, and they might, it's like ecumenics somewhere in Kansas, 20 people have a common banking account. And the group decides pretty much what's going to happen to the money. But it's in the context of an extended family notion, which I personally believe in theory. I haven't quite worked it out yet. I mean, that's the meaning of the Seattle community, and since we begin to move in that direction. But so that some guy might do that, and you might decide to spend half of the income of the 20 people for food, for send it crop or some program that you believe in. So I don't think there's any formula. I think what's involved is a kind of different way of looking at being in terms of responsibility and in terms of what we do with our being. So that
it is... I actually agree with that, Al, that responsibility, because I think so much of this attitude towards the self-sufficient little 5 acres is a terribly selfish attitude. You're comfortable and you can get along, you got more time with your kids and sit in the sun type of thing. But wow, I think you got a responsibility beyond that.
Most of the working we're doing isn't for the starving millions. Most of the work we're doing is to give people more refrigerators and more washing machines.
Correct, yeah, that's right.
I know in my line of work, I retail women's clothing. And just about the only good I can claim to be doing for the world is a half-hour lift that a woman gets from buying a new dress. In the long run, there's no real benefit that I'm giving by working 60 hours a week instead of 30.
Unless you get the money and do something creating with that. And I think that's a problem. I'd have a problem working in that kind of... I'd have a problem working producing big cars today. It'd be such a conflict in my psychic or spiritual life to do that.
I have a problem working for a physician. And Governor Brown suggested that to ease the malpractice problem, that the doctors offered to work one day a month free, I think. And so I suggested that to my doctor. And he says, of course, you will see that the staff is here working for you for the day too. And I said, okay, fine, and of course, and then talking it over with him, then of course, that wasn't the end. He says, you must make arrangements that I don't pay taxes, that I don't have to pay for utilities that day, and, you know, and then he goes on and on, and so you can, the whole idea, nobody wants to give of themselves. I think if I had my way, you know, I it's getting very difficult for me to work for a physician because it's too much, I don't want to say, I'm not against capitalism, but there's such an inequality. And in fact, one thing that government medicine does so prevent us from doing is what they call Robin Hood fees. We cannot treat someone poor for less money. We have to establish a profile for a certain fee schedule. And we used to treat a lot of people. I know people say, well, they didn't want charity, but doctors have done it for years. But you really can't do that under Medicare to a certain extent. And there's my nephew's in medical school, and I stopped to see him in Sacramento on the way up. And very difficult problem because he has a friend working at Mount Shasta. Only he feels very strongly about giving his medical services to his patients, you know, at minimal cost. About 60% of the people there are out of work. And yet he can't pay his taxes or his malpractice insurance or even pay help, an adequate salary to live. He doesn't mind living on a very small amount of money as a physician, even though, you know, but it's a real paradox. And we sit and we talk about this, and I think personally for my own integrity, I have to quit working for a physician. I really do. I don't know how to resolve that and why I've been doing it for 22 years.
If you're working for the wrong physician.
No, I work for neurosurgeons, orthopedic general practitioners. As I say, I love working for a physician who's truly dedicated. But my family resents it. My husband doesn't like me coming home from Nassau County. Right? For very, you know, a small amount of pay, because you often have to do that. It doesn't bother me, but...
Yeah, I think the institutions of society, the culture, makes it difficult to establish a different lifestyle and deal with things differently. And I don't know how it should work, but I guess I just have a theory that we need to begin to form congregations that involve all of being. And you can't involve all of being, but you move out toward it. So the congregation has the doctor and the dentist, and that involves problems too, but you do for each other, and somehow you manage to live through it. And that is, we become more an extended family. That's the kind of image I have, in which we're doing for each other, and in which we don't focus on our kind of career patterns in separate ways. And it's very difficult to do, but that's in a way, that's my idea of Holden. What happens at Holden is a very artificial place here, because you don't have the economic base, and you've got to function, therefore, in a big city, I think, for the most part. I don't say you couldn't do it in rural areas, but where you have to face all the issues, and the community not only does for itself, but it sees itself as a servant to, for the whole life, health, and economic, and political of the city, and eventually of the nation and world. Somehow, I see it as a withdrawal for the sake of, and a kind of pulling back from some of our institutions for the sake of. It's to try something different, and it is so difficult. And that's, there are some communities that are doing this. That's what Seattle is supposed to do. I think we ought to call this to official close. The bell is rung.